So today we finish this discussion of tensors, go back to the Lie algebra, write it in the Lorentz Lie algebra, write it in a covariant manner, and then move on to relativistic mechanics. And from the next lecture, we will go to field Maxwell theory and field theory. Okay, so. Here we go. So in the theory of relativity, we have not just vector spaces and bases, which we call usually frames, but there is also a metric, which is the Minkowski metric. So the Minkowski metric can be thought of. So sorry, let's phrase it a little bit more nicely. So we have a vector. Our vector space in this case is R4, and it is equipped with a map that takes two vectors and spits out a number, which is the Minkowski metric. And this is a bilinear symmetric map. So being bilinear and symmetric, we can diagonalize it, and we get an orthonormal basis, which is, of course, not unique. Which we denote E mu. And the signature of this metric is such that the zero basis vector has norm minus 1, and the others have norm three. Now, in components, eta, we find that eta e mu is eta e mu e nu. So this is relative to a certain basis. So this says that the signature is minus plus 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 plus. Now, we have seen the other time that when we have these maps, we can kind of dualize them and think of them instead of maps from V cross V to R. We can see them, for example, in two other ways. One is equivalently, eta can be seen as an element of V star cross V star, which in a basis would be that. When we think of eta in this form, or as a map from V to V star, and which is sending an eta x to eta mu nu x mu F nu. So these are all equivalent way of thinking about this object. In particular, this way of thinking about the map is particularly important because, as you see, it allows us to take a vector and define a covector. So this way of thinking will become part of our notation, will be embedded in our notation. So we define, given a vector x mu. We define x mu to be the image of this map over here. Now, similarly, we have that eta minus 1 is a map from V star, like the inverse of this map is V star V, and this as a matrix, if you want, is the same as eta, because eta in this basis is just diagonal, so with minus 1 and 1s, but technically speaking is the inverse of this map over here, and we use this one to define the opposite mapping, given a covector a mu, we define, so what is this? Sorry, I should have written it also like this. This is eta x e mu. We define a mu as f mu eta minus 1 x, sorry, a, should have written a, which in component is nothing else than eta mu nu a nu, where eta mu nu has the same type of structure here. In an orthonormal basis, of course. So this is all relative to, so when you see minus 1 and 1s is relative to an orthonormal basis, but in fact these expressions are more general. And you will use them in general relativity in a much more general, with a much more general meaning. Good. So the important thing is that eta mu nu, eta mu rho is delta mu rho. In an orthonormal. These are in an orthonormal basis. The difference of using an orthonormal basis and a more general basis is familiar from when you use polar coordinates, spherical coordinates, and so on. So in principle, one can use it. Even here, it's not really about general relativity. It's about using a more general set of coordinates to describe your flat space. So in principle, one can do the same thing in special relativity. Now, let's look back at quickly at the Lorentz algebra. So a Lorentz transformation lambda in SO. This is more general. I could put 031. So let's stay general. Is a lambda is a map from V to V. So from R4 to R4, in this case, from Minkowski space to itself. And we can consider the same as we did the last time. We can consider a change of basis given by this lambda and look at this vector in different frames described by, related to each other by different lambdas. Is that any questions over there? No. So thinking think of this as M in Monday's lecture. And then we find that the same vector, so X can be described as X mu E mu, or as well as X prime mu prime in the prime basis. Let's do it like this. In the prime basis with e mu prime being the basis transformed by lambda. So here I'm not really transforming the vector itself. I'm just transforming its, looking at different bases related by Lorentz transformation and looking at the same vector in different bases. So this x mu, x prime mu will transform, if you remember from last time, as lambda mu nu x nu. And similarly, if we have a covector, this transform as lambda nu mu a nu. By looking at how eta mu nu would transform, so we have that eta mu nu is invariant, right? So this, now I don't want, eta mu nu is equal to eta, sorry, invariant under Lorentz transformation, and this is lambda mu, so mu rho lambda nu sigma, no, sorry, rho mu sigma nu, rho sigma. And in particular, this means two things, that using our convention about raising and lowering indices here, we have that lambda minus 1 mu nu is equal to lambda nu mu. I don't really like this expression because, just a second. Because I find it a bit confusing to remember what comes first, what comes second, but you find it in books, in articles, so it's useful to know that this is something is essentially saying, a bit like in the orthogonal group, you have that the transpose is equal to the inverse. This is essentially the same type of relationship. Yes?
Can you just read that first line?
Sorry?
Read the first line. Can you read it?
Eta mu nu. So this is the relationship. Lambda transpose lambda equal eta. I rewrote it in components.
It's because I'm not saying. That's what I'm asking.
Eta mu nu equal eta prime, which is the one transformed in this way. And this is by definition. Lambda rho mu, lambda sigma nu, lambda eta rho sigma. So these two indices are contracted with those, and these two are the remaining two. So I will not really use this notation, but just as a reminder. And the other thing is, I'll go back to this in later, to something related to this one later. For now, I want to go. So any questions up to here? I want to summarize the Lorentz algebra next. OK, so you remember that we had the Lorentz algebra had the basis. A nice basis, which was given by ji and ki. Now, the question is, can we write this in a more covariant manner, like in a four-dimensional way? So it can be done. And so I introduce a big j mu nu with the following component epsilon ijk jk. So here we are saying that mu nu, this is the zero component, zero zero component is zero. This is f mu nu equals zero I. So this thing, you can take it as a definition if you want.
And
mu nu I zero. And finally, if mu nu is ij. So in my notation, Latin indices are always 1, 2, 3. 0, if I need to write it independently, I write it independently.
Mu nu goes from 0 to 3.
So, so now this is a matrix of matrices. And each of these is a 4 by 4 matrix. So what are the components of these of this matrix over here? Well, maybe I should have. These can be written quite nicely in the following way. Mu beta nu minus delta mu beta eta alpha nu. So this is an observation. You remember these were 1 and 0 is placed in certain places. If I look at that expression and I repackage it in this manner, I find this formula. So the two indices a priori play very different roles. They're mixed on the right-hand side, but play very different roles here. So these are indices that determine the basis of our, if I choose 0i, I get k. And mu nu are the entries of k. So they play quite different roles. But they are mixed in on the right-hand side. It's like it's a bit like saying this is the analog of saying that jk is, I don't remember which signs convention I'd used, but let's say plus or minus ijk. So this was telling us that j3 had 1 and minus 1 in the 1 was 0, 1, minus 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. So it's an expression analogous to this one over here. However, we notice that this can be written in an even simpler form, because what happens if we, for example, raise... We raise the mu index. We find that g alpha beta mu nu all of a sudden has an even simpler form, which is, since I raise it with eta, and eta is the is the inverse of eta with the indices below, this becomes this formula over here, which is nothing else than twice the antisymmetrized alpha beta. So this is now very, very nice and compact, and is essentially telling us that this object over here is antisymmetric in both the indices alpha and beta and mu nu, and symmetric upon swapping them. So it has, and so we went, now we are saying that if we write our Lorentz algebra, the basis of our Lorentz algebra with both indices up over here, instead of looking at this as a matrix in the that maps V in V, but as an object in V tensor V, then the algebra SO13 becomes isomorphic to the antisymmetric product of two copies of V. So this is the antisymmetrized tensor product. Or if we lower both indices, this is the same, of course, as also this. But I'd rather I wrote this one and we leave it. Okay. Now, was there? Yes.
I have a question. I'm a bit confused about the notation. Mm-hmm. So we know J and K are the basis elements for the Lorentz transformation.
Yes.
So J mu nu or J alpha beta doesn't mean just, does it refer to each element, each basis element?
Yeah, so for example, let's look at J 0i zero 03 mu nu. What is this? This is J03, I go up there. Well, maybe I'll look at 30 because it's a bit more convenient. 30 is K. So this is K3 mu nu. And and this one I can read off of this equation is also 2 delta mu alpha was, no, sorry, let me write it in full. So this is mu 0 minus 0 mu delta mu 3, which if I want to write in a matrix form, and I will tell you in a moment why this can be confusing, but let me write it in right now. So this has a when mu, we want the this is the entry. I tend to confuse columns and rows, but so this should be, this is 0 when the row is 0 and 1 when the column is 3, I suppose, or vice versa. Well, we leave it. You correct it if I'm doing it wrong. But and a minus 1 over here and zeros everywhere else. This is not the K we are used to. It has a minus 1 and a 1, and it is antisymmetric. The reason is that this is not the K we are used to is because the K's, as I define it in the other lectures, had one index down. So this is to be compared to K3 mu nu, which is G3 0 mu nu. And this was delta mu 3 eta 0 nu minus the opposite. And now we see that what changes is that here, when I have a 0 sitting around, there is an eta, and eta 0, 0 will be minus 1. So this flips a sign now. So I get, I should have done the opposite. So now this is flipping this sign down here. No, sorry. This was, then it becomes like this. That there's, I might have some global sign issue, but because this is definitely a minus one entry. Okay. Yeah, so I get minus one. Maybe there is a global sign problem in my notation, but it's not too important. So as you can see, it's important whether I think of this matrix as coming from two indices up or one index up and one down. And then one has to be careful about this. So that's why I try to avoid the matrix notation, because it's not helpful to distinguish covariant and contravariant indices, whereas in relativity, they are important. So how could have we, and this is a bit more compact because it's just about symmetric matrices. Whereas if you remember, in this form, the k's were symmetric and the j's were anti-symmetric. Whereas by raising an index, I am flipping the sign on a time on this column, and therefore and leaving everything else untouched, and therefore I get a basis of anti-symmetric matrices. How could have we seen this from scratch? So could have we directly. So yeah, so this is telling us that SO13 can also be thought with the appropriate indices in this form as this is the space of 4x4 anti-symmetric matrices. But one has to remember that the important thing is this index structure. So could have we seen this from immediately? And the answer is yes. Remember, do you remember this equation? So if you look at this equation, then we find that it reads like this. So we have these, and we have that the trace of lambda was 0, and this reads delta nu mu lambda mu nu equals 0. So we can also write this equation by lowering the indices as lambda sigma rho plus lambda rho sigma equals zero, and of course this is a consequence at that point. So this is not an independent equation, as we had already seen. So this is the anti-symmetric condition. So when we have both indices down, so this is the analog. So these are the matrix indices, not the alpha beta. We now say that lambda. Matrix. And therefore, lambda, we can write it in general as some components, alpha, beta, on times the basis. And if we want to look at it in components, we can put extra indices over here and put them where we like, essentially. Both up, both down, depending on the necessity. So this is... this is the analog of saying that lambda is lambda 0i ki. I hope I'm writing this i0 plus some other lambda tilde j, with lambda tilde I being epsilon ijk, well, 1/2, which is missing from my notes, lambda jk. So we are decomposing our lambda alpha beta over here. Well, maybe I should give different. This is slightly confusing, sorry, because these two have different meanings. So maybe I should call these. I don't know. Anybody has a good name for this? L? Let me call it L. L, like this. Okay. So these were the psis and thetas from last time. So this is the analog of psi I. And this, oh, I should have just called this psi. And this is theta I. I should have just called it theta I. Sorry. But that's. And if I were to put this matrix indices, they would sit here. And these are just now column of numbers and not matrices. So this is a matrix, and this is just an array of numbers. So it requires a bit of mental gymnastics because these indices look all the same, but they play very different roles. But yeah, one gets used to it. The main thing I wanted to emphasize is that is this transition. Sometimes you see that the Lorentz algebra, people say, oh, it's the space of 4x4 antisymmetric matrices. But this doesn't quite coincide with the definition we gave last time. And the reason is just the explanation is that it depends where you put your indices. You can think of it in both ways. Okay, so this, just as a last formula, is not the most enlightening one. I just, well, just want to write it for completeness. One can write the Lorentz algebra in terms of this J alpha beta. But again, it's not the most enlightening formula, to be honest. So what is J alpha beta? J gamma delta, but it sits in one line. This is eta alpha gamma J beta delta. So one picks one index from here and one from there and puts them here, and the other two goes there. And then the other term, you can get them by symmetry. So the exercise is find these by symmetry. Symmetry considerations. For example, you know that if you swap gamma delta with alpha beta, this should be get a minus one. If you swap alpha and beta, you should get a minus one. So this thing should be anti-symmetric in alpha and beta, and so on and so forth. So one can complete these terms just by looking at the symmetries of the object that you expect once you know the first term. So for example, I will need to add in here the term that swaps alpha and beta with the opposite sign. So there must be somewhere a plus eta beta gamma J alpha delta, for example. And I can continue. So there are four terms. OK. Good. So I'm changing gears. So if there are questions on this part, it's better to have them.
I want to ask, because I'm used to seeing contravariant or uppercase saying this is transforming with lambda and lowercase with the inverse of lambda. Mm-hmm. Is this because you transform the basis and
yeah.
The vector? OK, thanks.
Yeah, so. That you can think of a transformation as either a passive transformation or an active transformation. Here I'm taking the passive perspective. Active means that I would act with the Lorentz transformation on X itself. Here I'm not acting on X. I'm just using it to change my basis and leaving X the same. I prefer these because you give to X like an abstract existence. It is X is this vector on Minkowski space, whatever it is, and now I can look at it in different frames. So this X has a reality of its own, and I'm looking at it in different bases. And that's how I'm thinking about Lorentz transformation instead of an active act of boosting an object, accelerating it or doing something to it. Because in a way, that's physics, whereas here it's just about kinematics, how I describe that. So I prefer it that way, but there's no mathematical difference, except a minus one here and there. Okay, so and I think it's a useful way of thinking, especially in GR, where you want to change coordinates and so on, but you don't want to change necessarily the object that you're looking at. Again, even there, you can think of diffeomorphism actively, but I think it gets a bit confusing when one does that. Okay. So, recall back to basics. Let's recall Newton's second law, and we write it maybe not as F equal ma, but as dp dt equal F. And separately, as p equal mv. So one reason it's nicer to write it like this is because there can be processes that change m. So for example, a rocket burning fuel changes m, then this one has to take into account that, and this is the right way of thinking about it. And besides, is the right way in general, and the one that generalizes nicely. So of course, this equation is invariant under Galilean boost. What are these boosts? These boosts say that x goes in x minus ut, and t goes to t prime equal t. Now, if these are the law of Galilean boost, what follows is that p goes to p prime equal p minus mu. And the acceleration does not end. And therefore, since u is constant, the time derivative and t doesn't change, the time derivative does not change either. So this is why we are happy with this equation in Newtonian physics, because and why accelerations are the important dynamical object is because it's an invariant concept under Galilean boosts, which is the main symmetry of our theory. So this means in particular that if we want to look at we have to ask whether this equation is invariant under Lorentz transformation, and quite clearly it isn't. So we need to rephrase mechanics in a way that is compatible with special relativity. So this is the motivation. And we have to rethink things from scratch. So let me start from defining a space-time trajectory of a, or history, if you want, of a particle. So the picture is the following. So this is x1, x2, x3, and this is my time. So from now on, I will use c equal 1, because otherwise I will make too many mistakes. I will reintroduce it every now and then when it is relevant, but otherwise I will just forget about it. So we have that if I look at the particle in Minkowski space, it will follow some trajectory of this sort. And the important thing, as we mentioned at the beginning of this relativity section of the course, the crucial thing is that this word line sits inside the light cone. So by causality. So this is called the particle. Sometimes history or word line, just to use different terms that mean the same thing. And the particle also has to move towards the future. So of course, this is true at every point that it sits inside the cone. How do we describe this word line? Well, we introduce some arbitrary parametrization of the word line, lambda, lambda plus delta lambda, and so on. So this is just a parameter along our word line. The only condition that we want is that dt over d lambda be positive, so that this is monotonic going forward, and it doesn't is not a parameter that comes back to us. What I want to write here is gamma naught. Why? Because gamma naught. This is what I wanted to write. So this is our trajectory, our history. Same notation as I used in mechanics. Gamma is the history. But instead of parameterizing it with respect to Newtonian time, you use an arbitrary parameter. And at any value of lambda of the parameter, we will be at the point x mu in space-time. So the conditions of So we want this condition, which is just the condition that lambda is a decent parameter to parameterize this curve. And a more important condition, on the other hand, is that these trajectories has to move forward at all times. So causality tells us that x mu lambda 2 minus x mu lambda 1. Of course, this is the Minkowski interval between two points along the word line. This has to be negative, so time-like. Because we want a future point to be in the causal future of, well, we want the trajectory to be contain its causal in its causal domain, right? So this is the condition that it never went out of its own light cone. And infinitesimally, this is true if and only if infinitesimally d gamma mu over d lambda square is less than zero. So if it stays inside the light cone at a given instant, it will be inside at all other times.
What does the subscript eta indicate?
I just mean that this is the norm with respect to the Minkowski metric. It should be understood, and we'll not write it in the future because it's the only metric we have on space-time. So as we did in the last tutorial, things do not really, we saw that the parametrized particle was invariant under reparametrization of the lousy clock time. So this lambda is a lousy clock time. It's whatever parameter you want, and your description should not depend on which parametrization lambda you choose. So we want invariance under redefinitions of lambda. Okay. So this is C tutorial. It's the same concept. Oops. Now I want to introduce one more concept before going forward. I'll use again this figure over here. Well, maybe I draw a new one. So what is the instantaneous rest frame? This is a very important concept. So we have, again, our particle, our Minkowski space and our particle trajectory over here. So at this point, for example, the instantaneous rest frame is the Lorentz frame that, with respect to which this particle is still at that time. So it will be a frame. I put its origin here, but of course, where I put the origin is not too important. So this is the my x prime. Well, let me draw just one axis. So this is x prime, and this is t prime. And we want this to be tangent to the curve. So frame k prime. So k prime is the instantaneous rest frame at at lambda naught, if and only if gamma prime mu. So gamma mu in, sorry, d, I should write d gamma prime mu over d lambda at that point, which is the vector, the tangent vector, is of the form delta mu zero. So what does it say? It says that at that point, the particle is still and just moving forward in time, not moving left and right. So this here, it's crucial that they put the prime, meaning is the trajectory seen in that frame. But intuitively, it's just the frame. We boost to the we choose the frame that moves at the velocity that the at which the particle is moving at that instant. Okay. So this is This is a very important concept in special relativity. Because in a way, it's a frame perceived by the moving object. It's like sitting on the object, they instantaneously they find themselves in that frame. And in particular, this allows us to introduce the concept of proper time. So this is the time elapsed in delta in the particle frame. So if the moving object carries a clock, what kind of time is the clock showing is what we call proper time. So a change, what is the proper time elapsed between points lambda and lambda plus delta lambda? Delta tau will be what? It will be delta t prime in the instantaneous rest frame. But this is nothing else that delta t minus delta square minus delta x square in any other frame. And in particular, since we know that if we know the trajectory, this is nothing else than eta mu nu delta gamma mu delta gamma nu, in fact. Which we can also write dividing and multiplying by delta lambda as eta mu nu dx mu over d lambda d gamma nu over d lambda delta lambda. So of course this is all at first order computation, right? So we know so the elapsed time between the point lambda 0, lambda, and lambda 0 is of d tau, which is, so this, we can write it like this. And what we mean is and it's easy to check because it's exactly the same computation that, well, not quite exactly, but it's basically the same computation we did in tutorial, that this satisfies this requirement. Invariant under changes of lambda. And also changes of frame. The fact that is invariant under changes of Lorentz frame is manifest because this is a Lorentz scalar. But the fact that is invariant under changes of lambda is a simple computation that comes from the fact that we're looking at invariant distances over here. So the Euclidean analog of this quantity is the arc length of the curve, except that we're measuring it with respect to the Minkowski metric and not the Euclidean metric. is like the distance traveled along the curve in time, because this is moving forward in time, the proper distance. So the nice thing about proper time is that it's a very natural time to talk about the dynamics. And the reason is that, as you see, the fact that it does not change with Lorentz frame, it means that it's a scalar. So we don't have to worry about the way it transforms. We can take derivative with respect to proper time, and then they will not alter the way our quantities transform. For example, there, so we have dp over dt. Why this dt was so nice? Because t is a constant, is invariant under Galilean boost. So it does not change the nature of p. P was a vector, it stays a vector, because t is not affected by that transformation, by rotations or boosts. So here, the same. Tau is the quantity that is the notion of time that is not affected by changes of frame of boost, because it's an intrinsic notion to the trajectory of the particle. So we can use it to introduce derivatives of quantities of interest. So in particular, we introduce the four velocity as d gamma mu over d tau. So as I said, this is a four vector. This is a four scalar, which means, or a Lorentz vector and the Lorentz scalar. This means, by this I mean that is covariant with respect to Lorentz transformation. This is invariant with respect to Lorentz transformation. And therefore, this object together is a four vector itself. So this guarantees that if I define my four velocities in this way, they will transform nicely under Lorentz transformation. If I had taken dt, this would not be the case, because it's a frame-dependent notion. But the problem with the proper time is that it is quite hard to know a priori what proper time is, because it's computed through this integral, right? So it's always useful to be able to translate this back to the parameter lambda. And so this becomes so in a particular frame, if I want, I can do the translation. And what is dt over d tau? We have already seen this quantity. And now I'm sure I will get it the wrong direction. I think this is. And therefore, as a four vector, this will be gamma dt over dt and gamma dxi over or dt. And this is gamma v. So how do we prove this? Well, this we prove, let me do it quickly. This is dt squared minus dx squared. I just pull out the dt, and I find that this is v squared dt, which is dt over gamma. So this four velocity is nothing else than a four vector built out of the usual velocity, but corrected by factors of gamma to make it covariant. If I took 1v, this would not be covariant. If I put 0v, this would not be covariant. The right way of making the notion of velocity covariant is introducing this object. Now, this for velocity has a weird property, if we want, which is its norm. So this is this we knew, in a way. Remark, this is the time dilation formula, of course. So the remark is that the norm of u u mu is what? Becomes minus 1, but yes. Okay, so it's a constant. So the, and this is reflecting the fact that proper time is defined by knowing what the trajectory is. So we are tying our notion of time to the trajectory itself in space-time, and this is what this is telling us. This is telling us that proper time is defined like this, and therefore, this is, if you want, this is also telling us that in our rest frame, we move towards the future at speed 1. It's kind of a tautological statement, and this is why this is takes this value. Okay, now from the for velocity, it looks like a good idea to define a for momentum. So let's look at this. Again, it follows immediately that the four momentum has constant norm, which is the mass square. Now, I want to mention as brief aside. So what is this M? Depending on books, on courses, and so on, sometimes one introduces a rest mass versus a dynamical mass. So my M is always the rest mass. And I would say that's the only mass that exists. That makes sense to introduce because it's a scalar quantity, which is Lorentz covariant. Everybody in every frame will always measure, give the same value to M. However, to translate, to take the class, the Newtonian limit of relativity is useful to think in a slightly different terms. So let me mention this as an aside, and I will not talk about this ever again, I think. But one can also introduce a velocity-dependent notion of mass so that the momentum in a given frame is always mv, but with a velocity-dependent mass. And this mv is gamma v m, and this, which is my m, is the rest mass. It's called the rest mass. This is, in a way, if you're in a fixed frame, this can give some intuition as of why you cannot go past the speed of light. Because if you try to accelerate something, it will increase its inertial mass under this picture. And the more you try to accelerate it, the more its mass increases, and the harder it becomes to accelerate until the mass becomes goes towards infinity, and you cannot accelerate it any longer. But this way of thinking is tied to a specific frame and doesn't translate well under changes of frame, because there is always a frame in which the no matter how high the velocity is, there is always a frame in which the particle is at rest. So again, this is a concept that comes in every now and then, and it's useful when taking the Newtonian limit, but otherwise is not a useful relativistic way of thinking about things. So in particle physics, the mass of a particle is the rest mass, is not the. Now we can ask, so this is equal to n gamma. We can ask what is this p0, the time component of the four momentum. So we have an intuition of what the vectorial part of this of this object is, and it is a generalization of momentum. If you want, through this picture, we get a very concrete model of what this looks like. But what is, and here, let me reintroduce factors of C. What is Cp0? Cp0 is mc squared gamma v, and so if we develop these at around Low's velocities, we get mc squared plus 1/2 mv squared plus things which are higher order of order v squared over c squared. Say if v to the fourth over c to the fourth. So we see that this Cp naught wants to be is a relativistic generalization of energy, or better, a relativistic notion of energy. And importantly, even in a rest frame, this cannot be set to zero. And this is necessary to have covariance of your four momenta. So you're not free to, and this also means that you're not free to set, to offset your energy in special relativity by whichever amount you like. If you had a constant, you're doing something. And the reason you're doing something is that you want your four momentum to be a four vector which transforms covariantly. And these transformations will mix the time component with the space component. So I'm not free to put whatever I want in the time component if it's going to mix up with mv in the space component. And this is why special relativity is forcing us to rethink the notion of energy. I understand that this is a mathematical and not a physical explanation, but from Lorentz covariance, from the perspective of Lorentz covariance, this is why it comes about. So we will have a tutorial where we will look at the more physical picture for this fact. Of course, it has very important consequences. For example, it means that a particle at rest can decay in special relativity because there is enough energy that an object can decay into two smaller objects that move in opposite directions as long as the energy, the four momentum p mu is conserved. And this is possible now because to these so in classical mechanics, this would not be possible. Newtonian mechanics would not be possible because this is zero energy. This doesn't have zero energy, and so these would violate energy conservation. Whereas here, our concept is a bit more flexible. We start from a given energy mc squared, and here we have energies 2m gamma v, depending on what v is. And now, choosing appropriately little m, different from 1/2 of big M, we can tweak, we can compensate the rest by putting some velocity, and therefore it's possible for the particle to decay. So this has, of course, important not only this one, but this is one of them. Okay, now finally, after all of these, we have revisited the relativistic our kinematical framework, introducing word lines, four velocities, four momenta. Now we can give the relativistic second law. And this relativistic second law is that dp mu over, not dt, but d tau, that's the rule of the game, is equal to, well, maybe let me call it, so we call this the four force. So this is a little empty because I haven't given you an example of a four force. We will see one with the Lorentz force quite soon. Now, an important fact, which is due to the third law, if you want, which is that to every force there is an opposite force. It tells us that in a closed system where forces, there are no external forces acting, the total momentum is conserved. This is true also in special relativity. So conservation of total momentum. If you want, this is the third law. And and this in relativity becomes the following. It could even change the number of particles, that's not a problem, mu. In particular, this looks not super interesting at first, because one says, oh, this is just conservation of energy and momentum, generalized a bit. But this is also true for inelastic scattering. What is an inelastic scattering is a scattering is the opposite of the decay we saw before, where two objects collide and don't bounce off of each other, but get stick to each other. In general, is a type of scattering where there is apparently a loss of energy, so in the Newtonian sense. But in the relativistic sense, this is not a problem. What is happening is that, as we say, this is the opposite of the decay picture from before. What is happening is that the total mass here has to be bigger than the sum of the two masses. That's the only thing that has to happen. So in a way, if we take for good the thermodynamical explanation of what is happening in elastic scattering in the Newtonian physics, this is telling us that heat, which is the way we usually explain conservation of energy, we save conservation of energy in an inelastic Newtonian scattering. We say, oh, it's not that energy is not conserved, it's that we don't see it because it's lost in warming up the component, like the matter that makes the bigger ball. But now here, total energy is conserved, and so in the form of an increase of the rest mass of this object, so it means that heat must have weight. Well, weight is a concept related to gravity, so but has mass, has inertial mass. So let's be more precise. Heat has inertia, so it's a bit less catchy, but it's a bit more correct for now. So to conclude, let's have a look. Are there questions about that? I'm not giving more details because it's more interesting once we have an example of an explicit four force. Otherwise, there's not too much to say. One thing that I forgot to mention, sorry about that. I should have mentioned it when introducing the four velocity. Let me do it here quickly. If F is a scalar function on spacetime, I can define F, I can define a function F of lambda as F of gamma lambda. Right? Now I can, what is the, or if I'm parameterizing my my trajectory with respect to proper time, F of tau in this manner. Now what is the time derivative of F with respect to tau? Well, this is using the chain rule, u mu d mu f. So this is a very useful formula to know, to do computations. You will use it a lot in GR. So this is why I wanted to mention here. So this is the gradient as we introduced it last on Monday. And this is the four velocity. So the chain rule takes one step. This is df over dx mu, which is my gradient. And then there is d gamma mu over d tau, which is my four velocity. In particular, you can, so it's a directional derivative along the trajectory, right? So u mu is the is a four vector tangent to my trajectory. So that expression is nothing else than the fact that I'm computing the variation of f along the trajectory. So it's a quite intuitive. Now we want to look at an action principle for the relativistic particle. We have done special relativity. We have done Lagrangian mechanics. Why not putting them together? So what do we want? The question is, how do we, if we, I can give you the answer, but how do we guess this answer? So how do we guess an action? Well, what do the requirements are that it must be Lorentz invariant. And second, because we want Lorentz to come out as a symmetry, Lorentz transformations to be a symmetry of our system. And two, we want things to be parametrization invariants. So reparametrization invariants. So we want these invariants under lambda going to lambda prime equal f of lambda. So this doesn't leave us with a ton of options. We have already seen a quantity that satisfies these properties. So we want, so what kind of action? We want an action for gamma, of course, which is our trajectory, our history. So this will be just tau, essentially. So up, I think my convention wants a minus m over here. And we want from lambda 0 to lambda 1 minus eta mu nu d gamma mu over d lambda d gamma nu over d lambda. So this is of course, numerically this is true, but what we care about is the functional dependence of this quantity on gamma. So this is a numerical equality. This could also, well, yeah. So let's check whether this is the free relativistic part. This is another nice way to write it. It's the integral of the proper time along the history gamma, which is a bit better than what I wrote before. So let's check this. So first we compute momentum. So let me denote gamma prime equal. I know it's not the notation I used before, but for now, let me just use it as gamma prime as being the derivative with respect to lambda to make notation a bit lighter. So this will be what? This is gamma prime, so we get mu. So we get 1 over square root of gamma prime, and then we have m gamma prime mu. Oops, mu with the index low. So this is our p mu. But what is this quantity? If we look back at our definition of the four velocity, this is this is in fact mu. You can check that this is invariant under changes of lambda. And therefore, I can compute it for proper time. I get one under here and one up there. So the reason is this is invariant under lambda goes to lambda prime. Then choose lambda equal tau, and you finish. So this is nothing else than p mu. So this looks nice already like this. And then, of course, this does not depend on gamma itself. And therefore, the Euler-Lagrange equations are d over d lambda of of p mu, if you want, of pi mu equals 0. But since the relation between gamma and tau in this case is just if you want a gamma factor in a sense, it's just a prefactor over here. This is if and only if dp mu over d tau is equal to 0. So this is the free particle as expected. To conclude, I want to just quickly write down an action with a potential, which leads to a nice an interesting result. So consider I write it in two ways. As an integral in d lambda, we want m this is the free particle action, and then we want to add to this q some interaction constant, a mu computed at gamma lambda, contracting with gamma mu. So if we want a slightly nicer way of looking at things, so if you can check that this was invariant under Lorentz and invariant under reparametrizations. This is also true for this term, because we have a contraction between Lorentz indices, and gamma prime mu d lambda is also invariant under reparametrization. So this is invariant under 1 and 2. And how do we think of this in a more invariant way? Well, the first term is just m d tau. And the second term is minus q a mu integrated along d gamma. So if you don't like this way of writing things because it's confusing, this is the way to translate it. But this shows that this must be invariant under everything, because it doesn't depend on lambda in any way, and here is a contraction of a mu with the vector, essentially. So exercise, because I have no time left, show that find the Euler-Lagrange equation of this. And I will start from here next time.